Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm blessed to be able to announce that next week, sometime in the middle of next week, I will be going to Taiwan. The Archdiocese of Taipei has essentially invited me and two other Catholic evangelists to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ there. And in particular, given my heritage, I speak Mandarin and Cantonese, given my heritage and also the fact that I grew up in the Asian utilitarian context, to be able to speak to what the Church teaches about the dignity of the human person, which is a completely lacking concept in most, if not all, of Asia. Now, I share this because in my commentary in the second part, I want to speak about a topic about exactly that. I want to begin by talking with my friend, Dr. Gregory Popchick. Greg and I will be addressing the concept of the lifelong effects of childhood discipline, consistent discipline, discipleship, parenting, raising children well and consistently, and doing that with an eye towards their final end in Christ. And Greg will give us suggestions and techniques of how to do that fruitfully within the liturgy of domestic church life. We go on from there then to my commentary where my friend Brian Chainley asked me, how would you talk about the Eucharist with someone who doesn't even know if they believe in God or not, or doesn't even have a concept of belief in God? Well, it actually prompted a series of thoughts from me, and I want to walk you through it. How do you do that? How do you talk about the Eucharist with someone who has no sense of belief in God? Now, this will be good practice because next week when I go to Taiwan, many people whom I will speak to will come from this milieu and worldview. And then finally, we talk about the Busy Parent's Guide to the Catholic Faith. This is by Stephen Hemler. Has this ever happened to you? You're trying to put your children to bed and rush them out of the door in the morning, perhaps, and they decide that that's the perfect time to stump you with a question on the faith. Well, Stephen has a series of techniques and answers that we can provide our children in our busyness to keep them thinking clearly about these bigger questions about the faith, because make no mistake, children, all children are natural philosophers. They want to know the truth, and they need our help. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, February 24th. It's the Feast of Blessed Joseph Meyer Nusser. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Americans in Mexico are no longer being urged to shelter in place. The warning was issued after violence erupted following a top cartel boss being killed by Mexican authorities Sunday. Tijuana resident Ruben Diaz describes what it's been like there.
Yes, I am worried. For security reasons, somebody should stay at home, not come to Tijuana, maybe for a couple of days. There's no people. The schools are closed. A lot of stores are closed. Transportation is closed, like taxis, buses, everything's shut down.
The U.S. Department of State says public transportation and businesses are continuing to return to normal in Mexico. Erica Kirk is set to attend the State of the Union address as a guest of President Trump. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt confirming that the widow of Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk will be present for the remarks, which are expected to touch on Kirk's legacy after his death and reject political violence. FedEx is asking the Trump administration for full tariff refunds. The shipping giant filed a suit Monday after the Supreme Court struck down most of the president's sweeping tariffs. Nancy Guthrie's family is offering a $1 million reward as authorities continue to search for her in southern Arizona. It comes after multiple reports said that the person who was believed to have abducted Guthrie appeared to visit her house a day prior to her disappearance. However, local police said that's nothing but speculation as of now. And popular weight loss drugs by Novo Nordisk are getting a change in price. The cost of Ozempic, Wegovy, and Rybelsus will be cut up to 50% for some customers. The prices go into effect January 1st of 2027. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. You and I have undoubtedly seen adults behaving badly, and we sometimes wonder if they were ever disciplined as children. It's become a bit of a trope, and yet it's very true, because childhood discipline has lifelong effects, not just on how we behave, it also predicts the way we resolve conflicts as adults. We discuss discipleship discipline with Dr. Greg Popchak, who joins us every week. Founder and director of CatholicCounselors.com with his bride, Lisa Popchak. And he and his bride, Lisa, are the host of More to Life, a call-in advice program that's produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN. And they're also the developers and producers of the Catholic HOM app, the Catholic Home app, a resource helping Catholic families thrive. Greg, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Well, always a joy to speak with you. And this is a topic that you and I have anywhere from spoken about to joked about in the past. But sometimes you do look at adults wondering, gosh, did anyone say no to you as a child ever?
That's true. But, you know, one of the things that people don't often understand is the way we're disciplined tends to become the way we resolve conflicts in marriage as adults. You know, because the way we're disciplined teaches conflict management, or sometimes it doesn't teach conflict management. And so one of the points that we make, and we adhere to this approach in Catholic Home called discipleship discipline, which is rooted in the philosophies of St. John Bosco, his child-rearing approach, which he called the preventive system. But his approach really rejected heavy-handed punishments.
Right.
In favor of kind of building virtue, mentoring, practicing good behavior, and those kinds of things. And so we've observed that the five steps that are key, or at the heart of what we call discipleship discipline, in adulthood, say in married relationships especially, become the foundation for what we call compassionate problem resolution, or CPR. That the same five steps that we encourage parents to use in disciplining their kids through discipleship discipline are also a great five-step plan for handling marital conflicts more effectively.
And it really is a kind of CPR to the way the conflict... I'm sorry, I laughed at that. If the pun wasn't intended, it's still...
Oh, no, it definitely is. No, definitely is. Didn't mean to step on the lap. But no, it's intentionally funny, because I think that we need to sometimes jumpstart the heart of the relationship by approaching conflict in a more compassionate way.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And like I've told you, I've adopted a lot of the wisdom I've gained from you and Lisa and my own parenting. And I've seen the results, because there really is a component here where when we're trying to discipline by way of discipleship and modeling virtue, the emulation of that virtue becomes initially difficult, but eventually it becomes habit. So on the part of the person modeling as well as the person receiving the modeling.
That's absolutely right. And so let me walk through and just kind of give some examples of how this works both in parenting and in adulthood. So the steps of discipleship discipline in parenthood, and then what we call compassionate problem resolution, or CPR, in marriage are as follows. Number one, you want to identify the problem as opposed to attacking the person. So let's say your kid is speaking disrespectfully. I mean, it's easy to kind of get your back up about that. And of course, it needs to be handled. But instead of pouring gas in the fire by coming at the child in sort of a heavy-handed way, you can say, look, I understand that you're upset. How can you say that more respectfully? Let's talk about that, right? So you're identifying the problem, not attacking the person. Same thing with your spouse. Your spouse does something that hurts you. And instead of lashing out at them, you're such a jerk for acting that way. Why are you so mean? You know, being able to say, well, what's going on right now? You know, what's that about, right? So you're trying to approach it in a helpful way, identifying the problem as opposed to attacking the person, whether that's the child or your spouse. Second step is identifying the intention behind the behavior, right? So the child didn't do this just to make my life more complicated or more difficult. Feel that way, but they're trying to do something, whether that's express a feeling or express a need or solve a problem. They're just doing it in a ham-fisted way.
Right.
So if I can help them identify the intention, then I can know what they're trying to do. Same thing with my spouse, right? Instead of taking offense, hey, what were you trying to do when you said that or did that thing? It was kind of hurtful, but what did you mean by it? And they can tell me, and now we can start to go to the third step, which is identify more virtuous alternatives. Let's brainstorm different ways to handle this problem the next time it comes up. And we can do that both with the kid and with the adult, right? Then there's step four, will be relationship repair. You know, sometimes the things we do hurt the relationship. And so walking the child through, what are some things that you could do to kind of make this better? to either clean up the mess that you made literally or figuratively so that we can feel better about each other. Same thing's true in grown-up relationships. Okay, we figured out what we could do the next time this problem comes up. Is there anything that we need to do to reassure each other that we're in a good place and that we're taking care of each other? And then the last step is kind of plan for future success. Don't just assume that once, because we talked about it once, it's now resolved forever. Within childhood or in parenting, what kind of situations can I set up to either practice or role play this new behavior to make sure that as a parent, I'm staying on top of this and giving the kid opportunities to rehearse this new behavior or remind them, say, when we wake up in the morning, hey, remember, we talked about when this problem comes up, this is how we're going to handle it instead of this way, right? And so we build in these little structures that help the kid remember. Same thing in marriage. Okay, we've resolved the problem. Now, how are we going to make sure that we remember to do this new thing the next time the problem comes up? And so these five steps, work for parenting and work for adult relationships, because that's really what parenting is supposed to be about, teaching our kids how to have healthy, holy, and effective grown-up relationships.
And really, if we adopt all of this, I recall, even as you're talking, I'm having flashbacks to some of the students I taught all the way up till the high school level, age 18, and you realize that not mastering these steps manifest themselves in the way they conduct themselves in conflict resolution, even up to the point of graduation and after.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, again, People tend to think that parenting is just about stopping bad behavior.
Right.
And if that's our expectation, then we can use a whole bunch of tools that are just focused to that purpose. But really, parenting is not just about stopping bad behavior. It's about helping this child learn how to have relationship and have healthy relationship skills. And so a lot of parenting involves teaching kids how to manage conflict and solve problems. Yep. And those lessons are going to follow them for the rest of their lives. We can either teach them healthy ways to solve conflict and manage problems and resolve issues, or we can just teach them unhealthy things by just focusing on stopping the behavior. And so I often in marriage counseling, I talk to lots of couples who are just focused on stopping the behavior. My spouse upset me, so now, we stop that. as if change could be that easy, right? But walking through these steps, whether it's in parenting or in my adult relationships, kind of conveys that the coherent message about what it takes to solve problems, resolve conflict, and negotiate differences.
And I'm glad that you already brought up the marriage component, because the way we're disciplined as children eventually translates into the way we conduct ourselves as adults. So in our college career, our eventual work career, but also in our marital relationships, if we don't unlearn bad habits to relearn new habits, we carry them forward because they've become a part of how we resolve conflict.
Well, that's exactly right. And so what happens there is that we, we unconsciously rely on those scripts that we learned, from childhood about how to manage a problem. So my spouse does something that offends me, and in my right brain, right, it goes, well, let me just step back for a second. So when we're in a high pressure situation, like conflict, for example, our right brain's job is to go back through our catalog of experiences and say in a millisecond and say, well, this is sort of like that, go with it. Right. So if my spouse does something that reminds me of a situation that happened in childhood, my right brain is going to say that those things are equivalent,
right,
even though they're not. Right. And because that's how I make snap decisions in the moment. Mm-hmm. So the ways I was parented and taught how to resolve conflicts become my go-to script for handling adult conflict, even if it doesn't apply anymore. And so the more I'm able to use a similar approach with my children that I'm going to want them to use in adulthood to solve conflicts, the more I'm training their right brain to go back to experiences that actually would apply. Right. So instead of shaming my spouse for getting it wrong or trying to punish them for doing something wrong or, just freezing them out or whatever, that we learned from bad parenting interactions, we're able to have healthier, more proactive approaches.
Greg, thank you so very much for having this conversation with us.
Always a pleasure, Marcus. Thank you.
Greg and Lisa are hosting a conference, an online conference about this very topic. And so we're going to have the link in the description of this program in our archives on AveMariaRadio.net. I was talking to Dr. Greg Popchek of CatholicCounselors.com. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian prayer series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking, and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm August Vita. A little over a week ago now, my friend Brian Chainley introduced me to a concept that appeared in a National Catholic Register article. And it really was asking one question: how do you explain the Eucharist to someone who does not even believe in God? I'm traveling to Taiwan next week, and much of East Asia breathes the same cultural air. It's shaped by secular materialism. Because of that, I've been thinking about this question carefully. And I would like to start, I'd like to show you a trajectory I would use, because I started there myself. I would start with what every person has within them. There's a voice inside all of us. It tells us you should do something, you shouldn't do something. You should tell the truth, you should keep your word. You should not betray your friend. You know, that voice isn't something any of us invented. It's a universal norm. The Second Vatican Council describes it very simply. In the depths of his conscience, man detects a law which he does not impose upon himself, but which holds him to obedience. That's always struck me as a good starting point. I didn't create the standard that judges me interiorly. I find that even those around me, whether or not they believe in God, seem to have that same standard. And so all of us are measured by it. That's a good starting point. There's a universal conscience. That means we have a standard that's outside of ourselves, that's also within ourselves. The Catechism then explains further. The natural law present in the heart of each man and established by reason is universal in its precepts, and its authority extends to all men. In other words, that moral awareness is not limited to churchgoers or believers. In every culture, in all children, it shows up. The regret that every person has when they fail at doing something good. Scripture says the same thing. They show what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. That's Romans 2:15. So before anyone opens a Bible, there's that internal witness. If that law is real, then it points somewhere. And the reason why is very simple. Laws are a system of governance. And so systems, laws, they come from a mind and they are given to a mind. Obligations come from someone with authority. Again, we go back to the Catechism. Man has in his heart a law written by God. To obey it is the very dignity of man. According to it, he will be judged. That line is uncomfortable, don't get me wrong, because judgment is heavy. But human dignity is significantly more hopeful than the heaviness of judgment. Obedience to that truth makes us more human. So when I speak to someone who does not believe in God, I don't start with church language. I start with that shared experience. You already know you are accountable to something that's higher than your preferences. You already know that you fall short of your own standards. That's where the conversation with every person begins. But from there, I move to Jesus Christ as an historical figure. Christianity does not claim that God simply sends us advice in text. It actually claims that God entered history. I remember encountering Jesus personally, but also doing my research and realizing that the claims of the resurrection historically are basically historically irrefutable. The Catechism says, given all these testimonies, Christ's resurrection, it is impossible not to acknowledge it as an historical fact. Catechism 643. Even many scholars who don't believe in miracles admit that the earliest Christians were convinced that Jesus rose from the dead as a fact. James Ware notes that there's an almost universal scholarly consensus that 1 Corinthians 15:3-5 contains a carefully preserved tradition received by him within 2 to 5 years of the founding events. Now, for historical proximity, that's a huge piece of evidence, because that means that the message of the resurrection appeared socially immediately after Jesus' death. Myths and legends take time to develop. Paul writes, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received." Once again, it's not a legend. It didn't develop slowly over centuries. It is eyewitness testimony that was passed along quickly, carefully, and urgently. Historian Kenneth Scott LaTourette, he once said, "As the centuries pass, the evidence is accumulating that, measured by his effect on history, Jesus is still the most influential life that has ever lived on this planet." Now, sure, you can acknowledge that from a moral perspective, but that still doesn't prove his divinity. However, we've established at this point, this is a man who really exists. He died, and he rose himself from the dead. And there's more evidence to prove that than the lives of some other more significant historical authorities. So that's something. Let's move on from that. If Jesus truly rose from the dead, then his words matter. Well, in John 6, let's take a look at what he says. He says something direct and difficult. And even if you're not reading the Greek, if you're just looking at the English, "Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed." John 6:53 to 55. In fact, if you look at 55, some translations will say, "For my flesh is real food and my blood is real drink." It's about as tangible, as visceral as it gets. And in fact, if you go all the way to the end of John 6, many of his followers left him after hearing this. He didn't soften the statement. He didn't pedal back. He didn't try to explain it. He doubled down. And so the church has taken Jesus Christ at his word. The Catechism states again, "In the most blessed sacrament of the Eucharist, the body and blood, together with the soul and divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ, is truly, really, and substantially contained." Those words are precise. The Church believes that Jesus is actually present in the Eucharist. The Council of Trent explains what happens at Mass. By the consecration of bread and wine, there takes place a change of the whole substance of the bread into the substance of the body of Christ, which change the Holy Catholic Church suitably and properly calls transubstantiation. Now, what this simply means is this, pardon the philosophical language. The reality, the substance of the thing changes, but the accidents of bread, the appearance of bread and wine, those remain. That belief goes all the way back to the early church. Around the year 107, Ignatius of Antioch called the Eucharist the medicine of immortality, the antidote to prevent us from dying, but which causes that we should live forever in Jesus Christ. So he was writing of a doctrine he received from the apostles, again, from an historical perspective, 100 years, which is 107, so it's about 70 years after Jesus' resurrection. This was very close. It was close proximity in history. John Paul II summarized it this way: "The Church draws her life from the Eucharist. She rejoices in this presence with unique intensity." So the Eucharist is central to Christianity because it is Christ himself. And I saw this in a very personal way in Malaysia. And I remember that story from that piece in National Catholic Register. A woman there had never heard of Jesus. She had no background in Christianity. She was simply invited to sit quietly before the Eucharist in a chapel. No debate, no lecture. She sat in silence. After some time, she began to cry, and when they asked her why, she said, "He knows everything." She didn't have the vocabulary for advanced theology. She had an experience of being known by the God who is substantially present in the Eucharist. And that's precisely why the Eucharist was such a stumbling block for me coming into the Catholic Church. But now that I've embraced it, it's such a central part of my life, as is the case for every Catholic. Relationship comes before explanation, but explanation is still necessary. People are always open. They simply need to be asked. And that invitation can go further than our best arguments, but they still want us to engage them. So when someone sits in front of the Eucharist and senses that something's happening within them, something shifts. And once that something shifts, they long for deeper truth. If they've fallen in love, they want to know the person they've fallen in love with. Fulton Sheen put it simply, "The greatest love story of all time is contained in a tiny white host." There's very little by way of technical language there, and yet within it is some lofty theology. This is what the Church believes. God is not distant. He makes himself proximate. He makes himself close. He gives himself. And if you know nothing about other world religions, know this. None of them have a theology that says God pursues man. Christianity does. So, if someone asks me how to explain the Eucharist to a person who does not believe in God, I answer this way. Start with conscience. Start with the experience of moral obligation. Say that that points to a lawgiver. Show the historical evidence of the resurrection, then let Jesus speak for himself, and finally point them to the power of the Eucharist and encounter him there. It's not an abstract idea. That is exactly how I would do it. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
Take a look at our website, EWTN.com, and the old programs. I've so far gone through the encyclicals on Jesus, which is Redemptor Hominis, on God the Father, Divus et Misericordia, and on the Holy Spirit, Dominum et Vivificantem. Also the one on the Gospel of Life, Evangelium Vitae, and the one on Redemptoris Mater, Mother of the Redeemer. So I've gone through five of those, and you can get those off of our website. Again, the website is www.ewtn.com. And then when you go to libraries, what you can do is go to the audio library, and the audio library will have the old programs. They're all there, and you can just access them that way. May God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Has this ever happened to you? You're trying to put your children to bed, or you rush them out to the door in the morning, and then they decide that that's the best time, the perfect time, to stump you with a question about the faith. Stephen Hemler joins us with short answers to life's biggest questions. Stephen is the author of The Busy Parent's Guide to the Catholic Faith, Short Answers to Big Questions, president of the Catholic Apologetics Institute of North America, author of three other books, including The Reality of God. Stephen, great to speak with you. How are you?
Good. I'm glad to be with you, Marcus.
I'm very glad to be able to connect with you. And as we talk about this book, I want to, obviously this book comes from a place of very personal reflection. Children tend to be the best philosophers, and they love asking the hardest questions at sometimes the weirdest of times.
They do, yes. Especially as they get older, you know, they'll be dwelling on these questions and then all of a sudden get the gumption to ask you that sort of thing. So, it is an interesting situation.
Now, beginning there then, what's your personal story for why you penned it? What was the inspiration for the penning of this book in this way?
Well, it's kind of a long story. In my 20s, I would go on business trips, and as I was exploring these questions, how do we know God exists, the Bible, Jesus, what's the purpose of life, these big questions in life, I started writing up one-page summaries of these, answers that I came up with, and I called them my life's little learnings. And then we lived in Saudi Arabia. It's a long story. We were there for 13 years, really enjoyed it. We had CCD there and confirmation and priests. And this is in Aramco, Saudi Aramco, the oil company. And they wanted their students go off to boarding school in the ninth grade. And so they wanted something to equip these students for challenges to their faith and morals that they would experience at such a young age. So I took those life's little learnings and put them into PowerPoint with video interviews and things, and call it faith challenges. And then I'd long felt called to, serve God full time. And so when I was 55, I took early retirement as soon as I could from Aramco, and we moved back to Virginia, which is where we're from. And so we started the Catholic Apologetics Institute of North America. And since that time, we've done over 600 apologetics multimedia presentations in over 20 dioceses worldwide, and over 30,000 people spoke to. And then when I was getting started with CANA, Catholic Distance University, and they're now called Catholic International University, they approached me about, doing some online apologetic seminars, 3-week long online seminars. And so I developed those using, again, the PowerPoint. It went from the life's little learnings to the PowerPoint with speaker notes to these lectures. And so these lectures, when I was done with the first one, you know, compelling evidence of God's existence, I had a whole stack of them printed out, and I said, well, shoot, I could make that a book. Never intended to ever write a book. God has amazing ways of you know, prodding us along. And so I developed the first book, The Reality of God, The Layman's Guide to Scientific Evidence for the Creator, based on that seminar. And then they wanted more seminars, so that led to two more books, Search No More, the Keys to Truth and Happiness, and Catholic Stories of Faith and Hope, How God Brings Good Out of Suffering. They're all published by TAN. Well, I still had these Life's Little Learnings, the one-page summaries, and several people suggested that we really need to have something for parents, that this, instead of just, you know, Life's Little Learnings, make it a book for parents. And so that's what we did. Scepter Publishers picked it up, Mike Aquilina, and so these big questions we all address, you know, they're short, one at the most two typewritten pages. And so parents are very busy, and the questions are very specific and unique, so you don't have to sit and read the book from one end to the other. You just go to the questions, you know, about God and creation, Jesus, the suffering, salvation, the Catholic Church, and then life and sex. And so those are the various topics. And so that's how it came about. God just had this plan, seems like, from the very beginning, and here we are.
Well, I'm really glad you shared that story, because numerous parents are listening to this thinking, you know what, I would love to be more equipped to be able to dialogue with my children, my younger siblings, or perhaps even my grandchildren on these topics. So
right.
Your book is a distillation of a lot of the talks that you've been giving across dioceses across the world. How do you propose people use this book?
Okay, well, there's a couple ways. One is to just, you know, questions come up, you know, as a parent, read it, or as a grandparent, like you mentioned, or anybody, any family member or friend, and read about that question and then discuss it with their child. Most of these questions are for teenagers and older, and we find that 80% of people who leave the Catholic Church do so before they are, I think, 20 years old, 23, and almost half of the people who are raised Catholic no longer call themselves Catholics. So it's a major problem, and most of them leave because they stop believing what the Church teaches, and they may not even have ever even known, you know, much of what the Church teaches. And so only 40% of teenagers believe in God with absolute certainty, surveys show. So it's important to be able to answer these questions as they come up. But the other thing you could do is also give the book to your child, especially, you know, the older children, teenagers and college students. And if they have a question, you know, refer them to a specific chapter, or just let them, you know, read the chapters that are of interest to them. This book does have, I need to mention this, the imprimatur, the approval of the Bishop Burbage, Michael Burbage, of our Catholic Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. So the content is theologically sound. It was reviewed extensively, and parents can be assured that the answers presented are good, solid, correct answers.
Well, I'm really glad for that. And so what I want to do is to go through some rather big picture questions, chief among which is the existence of God. I think many of our listeners right now would be able to attest to the fact that many people in their families, children, grandchildren, have left the faith and, frankly, are attesting themselves to be nuns. So let's begin there. The fact that the existence of God, or at least God as existence, is a knowable truth.
It absolutely is. And there, and in this book, and then, of course, in my first book, scientific evidence of God's existence is presented, and as well as the human evidence. There's evidence within human nature, and a lot of people think all this is pretty compelling. But most people today go with science. You know, young people, if science says something, then they tend to take it seriously. And what I call the rest of the story is the scientific evidence of God's existence in three areas. The first is the Big Bang. We've heard about that. But then what are the implications of that? And then there's the laws of nature and the fine-tuning. And if I could go through those briefly. So the Big Bang is when the universe came into existence about 14 billion years ago. It's when space, time, matter, and energy were all created. And most people don't know that this was initially proposed by a Belgian Catholic priest, Father George Lemaître, in 1927, based on Einstein's general theory of relativity. And this was confirmed by Edwin Hubble, the Hubble telescope fame, in 1929, that the universe is expanding. And so if you rewind the clock, it all comes back to a single point in time. And
let's pause there, Stephen. The music is hitting, but we'll pick up on the other side of the break. I'm talking with Stephen Hemler, president of the Catholic Apologetics Institute of North America, and he is also the author of The Busy Parent's Guide to the Catholic Faith. It's a question and answer format for any parent, or any person really, to pick up and start dialoguing the fundamental truths of the Catholic faith. Continuing on the other side, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here, and I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces." If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we? The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
What is the essence of the fourth commandment? In ordering us to honor our mother and our father, the Lord God has willed that after him we should revere our parents to whom we owe life and who have handed on to us the knowledge of God. The Catholic Catechism says the fourth commandment shows us the order of charity. It introduces the subsequent commandments concerned with special respect for life, marriage, earthly goods, and speech. It constitutes one of the foundations of the social doctrines of the Church. It is expressed specifically to children regarding their relationships to their parents because it is the most universal. But it also involves ties of kinship to the extended family and encompasses duties to elders, ancestors, pupils to teachers, employees to employers, citizens to their country, and to those who govern it. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio Travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Speed. I'm talking with Stephen Hemler, president of the Catholic Apologetics Institute of North America, and we have been talking about his new book, The Busy Parent's Guide to the Catholic Faith. I want to present this as an option to everyone listening right now. This is a really easy read, but you don't have to read it cover to cover. You can go topic by topic as questions are asked of you so that you and your child, your friend, your grandchild might be able to dialogue these fundamental truths of the faith. Stephen, we got cut off by the break. I want to invite you to keep speaking to the very logical fact that we can understand by reason that God really does exist.
Yes, especially science. And I was talking about the Big Bang, the scientific discovery that our universe had a beginning. That was a surprising discovery in last century cosmology. And of course, nothing comes from nothing. And if everything came from nothing, then this is, a lot of people think, pretty compelling evidence of a transcendent creator outside space and time who ignited that Big Bang. And you would think, after a violent beginning, an explosion like the Big Bang, that the universe would behave in a random, chaotic, and unpredictable manner. When I talk to students, I always ask you, when you play with firecrackers, does it make things a mess, or do you get order and harmony? Well, it makes a mess. But our universe is surprisingly well-ordered and predictable. The seasons come, the seasons go. The sun rises, the sun sets. They're all governed by the laws of physics. These mathematical expressions of the laws of nature that explain the order, harmony, and regularity that we see in the universe. E equals mc squared is the most famous one. And so the second of the evidence of God's existence that we talk about are these laws of nature. And a big question comes up, did Einstein, Isaac Newton, F equals ma, these scientists, did they create these laws of nature? Or did they merely figure out a mathematical expression for a pre-existing law of nature that's out there? Well, they didn't create them at all. So if they didn't create them, they just figured out how to express it mathematically. Where did these laws come from? And why is there a mathematical foundation to the universe, E equals mc squared? And where did that come from? And why is it understandable by human intelligence? So it seems that these laws of nature that are intelligible, we can understand them since they were created by an intelligence. These mathematical laws of nature that take the greatest efforts of the finest human minds to unlock must have come from mind, capital M, far greater, and that would be God. And so this is what did it for me in high school when I realized about these laws of nature, these mathematically elegant laws of nature. How I could conclude that God exists. Well, about 50 years ago, scientists made another discovery that points to evidence of God's existence, and that's called the fine tuning of the universe. In these laws of nature, there are many constants. You know, C is the speed of light. And these numbers, there's about 20 of them, in the mathematical expressions of the laws of nature, they're all set to precisely what is needed for life to exist, for us to be here. If any one of them was just a little bit different, we wouldn't be here. And so it's like there's dials on a wall that have all been set for tuned, finely tuned for us to be here. And so if there's fine tuning in the universe, science has discovered, then that's some pretty compelling evidence of a fine tuner that set all those dials just right. And Sir Fred Hoyle, who was initially an atheist, but Cambridge University astrophysics and mathematician, he's the one that came up with that name, Big Bang. He just dismissed it. You know, it's just a Big Bang. But he came around with this fine-tuning. He said, a common-sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. And so there is some pretty compelling evidence. It's what I call the rest of the story. They're not going to get it in school, students, and they're certainly not going to get it in TV. So it's important to be able to, and our presentation on this, by the way, if you go to our website, canaweb.org, CAINAWEB.org, if you go there, this presentation is filmed and available for viewing, as along with our other ones. Another presentation that young people really like is the one on the medical studies of near-death experiences and how they show pretty conclusively that we have a soul and that our soul survives bodily death and you know, we're destined for either heaven or hell. You know, there is an afterlife. So there are a lot of reasons to believe that we talk about in the book and in our presentations.
Now, from there, I want to repackage the conversation, or at least move the conversation along to the question from Desire, because you've presented us a lot of very systematic ways of thinking about the universe, but there's also the reality that there are desires within us, as C.S. Lewis talks about in Mere Christianity, that aren't fully fulfilled on this side of the veil. Right. How does that speak to the existence of God?
Yeah, that's very important as well. These human desires, we desire perfect knowledge and perfect love, but we don't have either of those in our world. So how do we know what they're like? You know, we seem to have this innate awareness of and desire for perfect knowledge and perfect love within our consciousness. It's part of our conscious self. And so it makes no sense for us to seek that which is unattainable. We only seek that which is attainable, if not here, then in the hereafter, that God is the source of our conscious desire for perfect truth and perfect love. And what we're seeking is God, who is the perfect truth and perfect love. And you mentioned C.S. Lewis, and he said that creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. He says, a baby feels hunger? Well, there is such a thing as food. He said, if I find in myself a desire which no explanation in this world can satisfy, there's actually five of them, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Mm-hmm. So many people believe that this is compelling evidence of God's existence within our conscience. You know, we have this voice in our head that's trying to get us to do right and avoid wrong. And do we have to follow our conscience? No, we have free will. So why did God give us this conscience that is not necessary to follow? You know, why do we know this right from wrong? It seems that we are to use our free will to do what is right and avoid what is wrong. And even though we're guided by our conscience, we are free to do otherwise and often do. So why do we have a conscience, and where does it come from, especially if it's not totally effective at getting us to do right? And C.S. Lewis, in his book Mere Christianity, as I'm sure you know, he goes into this famous explanation of our conscience, what he calls a moral law in our hearts, points mm-hmm. to God's existence. And so that's compelling evidence within human nature as well. It points to a creator, as he said, who is intensely interested in right conduct, in fair play, unselfishness, courage, good faith, honesty, and truthfulness. And it shows that God not only created the universe, but he, through our conscience, he's taken an interest in each and every one of us, and he cares about our personal moral choices. So all this we sum up in the book. We call it the three C's as evidence of God's existence. The first is the cosmos, mm-hmm. the universe, the Big Bang, the laws of nature, and the fine-tuning we were talking about. Second is our consciousness and these desires. We seek perfect love, perfect truth, and also our conscience, the cosmos, consciousness, and conscience. So these are pretty compelling evidence, many people believe, I certainly believe, of God's existence.
You did not shy away from touching on the brilliance of St. Thomas Aquinas, who himself endeavored to use reason to demonstrate knowing the existence of God. Tell us about that.
That's interesting. Yes, it is very important, and he calls it actually proofs of mm. God's existence. And we do talk about this in the book, that as evidence of God's existence. But I find today that most young people, philosophy doesn't seem to sway them very much. And it seems like science, and you know, we're talking about within human nature, that has more of a sway. But we do summarize Aquinas's five ways, he calls them. The first mover, or argument for motion, and these are all a little bit esoteric, but we did summarize them in a way that people can understand them. First cause, or argument from cause, supreme order, intelligence, or argument from governance of the world. That's where science can come in as well. And so these are three of those five ways that are mentioned in the book.
Now, we can go on and on about different arguments for not just God, but the reality of the Genesis story. But I want to step back into the bigger picture conversation, which is when you read through the entirety of the book, it's very clear that they all present one clear picture, that the Catholic Church does in fact contain the fullness of truth. And so boldly proclaiming it means being unafraid of questions.
Absolutely. And that's why we feel it's so important to equip. I mean, teachers, educators, catechists will appreciate this book. Confirmation class teachers and that sort of thing. So it's not just for parents. It's for parents, grandparents, as you mentioned, godparents, other family members, and certainly educators, teachers, and catechists. And so to be able to answer these questions is, I think, very important in helping our young people stay in the faith, that many times they are not finding answers that they find satisfactory. So again, these answers are helped to keep them in the faith.
Now, rounding this out, we were going to have all of your contact information available in the description of today's program. But Stephen, thank you very much, not just for penning this book, but also for making the time to speak with us about it.
Well, it's been a pleasure being with you, Marcos, and I'm glad you had a good time on the Good News Cruise. A deacon friend of mine gave Bryant, your assistant, a copy of the book, and I'm glad you picked it up.
Oh, well, we were glad to receive it. My guest has been Stephen Hemler, president of the Catholic Apologetics Institute of North America. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Busy Parent's Guide to the Catholic Faith. It's a very easy read, and if your child has any question about the faith, just go to that chapter, see the answers, and engage it boldly with your child, because the Church has the answers. I'm Marcus Peter.